Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with Gary Vasilash and John McElroy, episode 347 for September 16th, 2016. Here we go with Elio. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube. Good afternoon, everyone. As you can see, John is not here. John is traveling, and speaking of traveling, I just got back from Chicago this morning, and I was at the IMTS technology show. And I got to tell you, I saw one of the most amazing things I've ever seen at a trade show or anywhere else. So, Carmen, could you bring this picture up? Here is an industrial robot that was picking up this Corvette. And, I mean, it was picking it up all the way to the top. It was spinning around. It was just doing all kinds of maneuvers with that car, just showing how powerful these robots are today. So because I have automotive experts in the room and because I have an engineering guy in the room, I think we can investigate this a little bit. So first of all, I want to introduce, I don't think we need to introduce, Chris Pocket of Roadshow by CNET, because he's been here many times.
Thanks. Always great to be here.
So have you ever seen anything like that?
Only Captain Caveman, when he's just upset and he's just, you know,
that's
ramming something
that's,
big.
That's pretty cool.
But no, that's amazing.
That is pretty amazing. Yeah. And Lindsay Brook from SAE, from the Automotive Engineering International and all of these other magazines that they have.
Good to see you.
So how you been?
Thank you. Been fine.
Yeah?
I've never seen a robot that could pick up a Corvette.
Yeah, it was amazing. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
And our special guest, as I'd mentioned, we've got Jeff Johnston, the VP of Engineering of Elio Motors. So, okay, as an engineering guy, have you ever seen anything like that?
No, I've never seen anything like that, Gary, but I'll make one comment. We need to have an Elio like that instead of the Corvette.
Maybe at the next show that they'll do that for you. All right, so Elio Motors, okay, so a lot of people are familiar with it, but there are a certain number who don't know about this. So tell us what this is and what you guys are trying to accomplish, because it's pretty revolutionary.
Yeah, it is. It truly is. You know, there's some main features that we're trying to hit. And, of course, the one that's always spoke about is safety by Paul. So we want to make sure that we're very safe and we're driving safety. But some of the great things that come along with that is that we're going after the 84 miles per gallon through our analysis. We're getting real close to that. Our one that we just did last Friday came through at almost 83 miles per gallon. So we're
okay, but you got to tell us what this vehicle is, because it isn't a car like others are familiar with.
I'm sorry. All right. So it's a three-wheeled vehicle, right? So we have two wheels in the front, one in the rear. We have tandem seating, which is the person driving up front, and then we have the passenger sitting in the rear of the vehicle. So it's definitely different in that aspect. But it's also a thrill to drive because you're in the center of the road and you have a good feel and you can see real well. Engine-wise, we have a 55-horsepower motor with a 55-foot-pound torque. Gas, as far as the tank, we're at 8 gallons, roughly, a little bit larger. So it's some basics there in that aspect. We got air, we got power windows, we got a lot of good things going on with the car. And, of course, the main driving force is that we're targeting that $7,300.
Okay, so two questions. Why the architecture in terms of the two wheels in the front and the one in the back?
Okay.
And secondly, why the tandem seating?
Okay, tandem seating. So the whole thing that Paul has is the aerodynamics-wise.
Paul Elio, who founded it.
So, you know, the whole thing is aerodynamics-wise. So narrow the vehicle. Of course, that you're pushing less air through the whole event. So with that being said, that drove the tandem, front and rear, of course. And then the front-wheel drive aspect of it, we're using a lot of carryover components. We're designing front-wheel drive, basically. So we're using, you know, components that are already out there, and it lends itself perfectly to front-wheel drive for us.
Mm-hmm. And is steering and maneuvering easy to do?
Very easy to do. We just finished up our E1A. We had Roush dial in the suspension for us. Peterson Spring and Gabriel dialed in the shocks for us. And we were handling it like crazy through some of the test tracks and some of the tracks that we have behind our facility. Handled terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing on how it did.
Mm-hmm. Is the engine an off-the-shelf piece as well?
No, engine is not. So IAV is who we're working with for the engine. They're designing the three-cylinder for us. It's a 0.9 liter, but no, it's not off the shelf. So the technology there that they're putting into the heads for us and to the pistons themselves, it's helping us to enable us to get to that higher mileage.
And, Jeff, you mentioned some suppliers, and when people ask me about LEO, I tell them, and they say, isn't this just like every small car startup that we've seen, you know, people that have big ambition, but for some reason don't really gauge what it costs to get into the industry? And I said, from what I know of this project, a big difference is these guys are paying their suppliers. You know, IAV, Continental, these are global suppliers that wouldn't be working with you guys if you weren't properly funded. Could you talk about, where the basic funding of the company is coming from?
You know, that's sort of out of my realm, but I'll have to leave that one up to Paul, right?
Is it venture capital? Is it couple golden,
Well, I think he has some high-level investors that are certainly helping out. We did the Reg A Plus and some of the other events that have happened in the past as well. But I'll stick to the engineering side of it because I'm not good at the financial side of it. But
okay.
Well, you talk about the engine. What about the transmission? What kind of transmission do you have in this vehicle?
It's a 5-speed transmission. It's an ISIN transmission.
Mm-hmm.
So like we talked about, you know, with IAV and Continental and others being involved, ISIN's is another high-level supplier, right?
Sure.
It's part of the Toyota family,
mm-hmm.
and they've been spectacular with us. We're using carryover transmission, with the exception of we're tweaking some of the gearing
mm-hmm.
so that we can get some of the higher mileage out of it for us.
So it's a manual gearbox?
It's a manual gearbox, mm-hmm. exactly. So then we'll have an automatic manual transmission after that. So I don't know exactly when we're going to come in. It will be within the first year of production, but it has the solenoids that does the shifting for you.
So somebody just puts it in?
You'll just put it in drive like you do a normal car, and through the body control module, the engine control module, it'll sense what's going on with speeds and whatnot, and it'll do the shifting for you.
Hmm. Kind of like the original Smart 4.2, but hopefully better executed.
Yes, a lot better executed.
Hopefully a lot better.
Yeah. I've driven that, and you had to sit and make a left. It took quite some time, but yeah. Definitely executing that better.
So I wanted to ask you from an engineering perspective. You had a lot of experience with four-wheeled vehicles prior to this,
yep.
but now a three-wheeled vehicle probably has its own set of engineering challenges. What's the biggest challenge? Is it crash performance? Is it packaging? Is it NVH? What is it?
Well, the challenge is that you have a $7,300 vehicle, right? So we got to figure out how we design to keep that price low and using off-the-shelf components and designing properly. You know, we're using an analytical as much as we can. But the biggest thing for us is, you know, lengthwise, we're a long car. We got a 110-inch wheelbase. And the problem is when you narrow it down. So when you go to put the HVAC unit in behind the instrument panel, when you got to condense everything into a smaller area, it's difficult to package. So the team's doing a great job. And when I say the team, it's the supply base and everybody on coming together, packaging it all in there so that we have an effective car.
And you talked earlier about aerodynamics with the body shape.
Yep.
What is your basic CD of this car? What are you aiming for?
So we're at 0.3 right now,
hmm.
and we have a rolling resistance of 0.008.
Hmm.
So Continental Tire did a great job for us on giving us a new compound and a slightly different shape of the wheel for us, which gave us that low rolling resistance. So helped out significantly on the last run that we did in regards to miles per gallon.
What's it made out of?
Mm-hmm. So it's a typical unibody
mm-hmm.
For the underneath. Nothing different. You know, we use typical techniques for a unibody.
Steel unibody.
Steel unibody, exactly. And then the outer body, we were running with SMC. We made the change over to steel. I heard Jeff Janssen's talk before about the weight of the car and everything else, and that's one of our biggest factors, right? Because weight affects us the most. You know, we're trying to get to a 1,350 target. And with that being the case, I had to get the steel in order to take some of that weight out. Mm-hmm. Plus, you know, we're driving towards the 250,000 units. So in doing so, I got to be able to have the right amount of components coming into the plant.
You had to engineer this with the anticipation of making that many vehicles?
Yes. Oh, yes.
So this isn't just a, you know, we'll make a few hundred and say.
No, not at all. Not at all. We're driving right to the 250,000 units.
And you're in the former GM Shreveport plant, right?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the regulatory pressures on a vehicle like this? This isn't something that's subject to normal passenger car crash test standards, for instance, right?
Exactly.
And state to state, it's legal as a motorcycle or it's legal as an autocycle or what have you. Can you?
So right now, we're federally, we're labeled it as motorcycle. So I need to meet the FMVSS standards relative to a motorcycle, which is very limited. What Paul is doing for her, as always said since day one, is that, look, we're definitely a motorcycle, would be classified as a motorcycle, but we're going to drive as far to the right as we can to be representative of an automotive-type FMVSS standards and certifications and whatnot. So the team that I'm working with, we're all driving towards the automotive standards.
And is it correct that only West Virginia now, I think, doesn't have this variance for autocycle? It was only a couple states.
There's only a couple of states in there, Lindsay, but the answer is yes. Uh-huh. In fact, I just talked to Joel on that, and they only go into session 45 days a year.
West Virginia does.
So their session hasn't come up for us yet so that we can be voted upon. But Joel Sheltron, that does our government affairs and interfaces with them, has done a great job and has gotten all the classifications pretty much wiped out. So the answer to your question is, no, you don't need to have a motorcycle license and whatnot. You don't have to wear the helmet. I think a few states is, if you're under 18, you have to wear a helmet, but it's not too bad.
Okay, we got a question here from our work. I've been wondering since I first saw the Elio, why is there no bumper protection for the front wheels where you'll need marker lights at least? The recent three-wheel electric vehicle, the Solo, has a bumper across the front protecting the wheels.
Okay, interesting point. Aerodynamically, that plays a big factor in for us.
Okay.
You know, we are dialing in the upper control arm, the lower control arm, everything that we can to take away the airflow, right, so that we have the lowest drag. Mm-hmm. So I haven't thought about it, I'll be honest with you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, putting that beam all the way across the front of us would be a huge effect.
All right, and then speaking of the aerodynamics, the Griffin wants to know, how about the CDA?
The CDA. Off the top of my head, I don't remember it off the top of my head.
Fair enough. And right now, it's trying to slip one in. Are there going to be other models coming in the future?
I will say this. There's a lot of talk, yes.
Mm-hmm.
There's stuff tabled because we're focused on getting to, you know, production right now.
Sure.
Is this a platform? In other words, is it a platform that can other things can be spun off?
The potential's there, but we'll have to see what comes out of that.
All right. Okay. So are you guys going to be doing it just the normal way where you batch build a whole bunch of cars and then you send them to places that people go and buy them? Or are you guys going to be tailoring cars to individuals as they come in to buy them?
So when they walk into the buying a vehicle, there's two choices they have to make: color and transmission. So all of our vehicles will leave the plant with that premonition. So we're only building those 14 different styles. Now, what Paul has done is a great job of setting up and adding accessories after that. So we have marshaling areas that we'll be utilizing to personalize the vehicle for whatever accessories they would like to add.
Mm-hmm. So it's engineered from the start, anticipating that you're going to be plugging these modules into things.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So does the car meet motorcycle emission standards or automotive emission standards?
We're driving towards automotive.
Okay.
Although automotive it's a long cycle to go through that whole certification, but we're putting in the proper steps to do that.
Okay.
So initially I'll qualify as a motorcycle and then shift over to the automotive.
Okay.
We've got a question that is being phoned in. So Carmen, could you please bring the telephone call in?
This is Clem Zarovsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, similar three-wheeled vehicle sold by Bombardier and sold by Polaris cost at least $25,000. How can you build an enclosed vehicle for under 10? That's my question. Thank you very much.
That's a great question.
Yeah, great question. Very, very good question. So this is, once again, you know, the model that we have with Elio is using our supply base, right? Bringing all that knowledge in. So where that comes in is the volume on those vehicles and the technology that they use to assemble those vehicles is totally different than what we do. We're using techniques that are done by the automotive industry. So therefore, it's allowing us to assemble at a lower cost.
Mm-hmm. And I think you may be going after a different buyer, too. Is that fair to say? I mean, something like the Can-Am Spyder or, you know, some of the other options that are in the market, the Slingshot, for instance, they're really enthusiast-based, maybe people that are coming out of motorcycles that no longer have the ability or want to, you know, be just on two wheels. This seems like it's more commuter-focused. I mean, you're talking about a high miles per gallon as a central feature. Can you talk a little bit about who you expect the typical buyer to be?
You know, it's hard to say at the moment, but the answer is yes. I can talk to it a little bit here. You know, we've gotten over 59,000 reservations now. So with that, it's a good range of people from the age of 40 to 55, right? So we've captured that market. The big driving force, I think, for us that's going to come along is the mobility for the lower income class. It's going to be mobility for the college student, the high school student, things of that nature. So I think we'll see a lot of that evolve as the car comes out. So I think it'll appeal to every step of the way as far as life goes on attracting different people.
You just mentioned your engineering development vehicle that you have with Roush. When is this going to come to the market?
In 2017 we'll be to the market.
2017?
Yeah, exactly.
Can you talk a little bit about any of the electronics on board? Will you have things like stability control, ABS, lane departure warning, that sort of thing?
Sure. We're going to keep it simple, okay? I'm a simple guy as well, so we're going to keep it real simple. But the answer to your question, ABS is a must for us. It's a safety item, so Paul drives us on that one. ESC is another one that is a must as well. Lane departure, I don't have that in there. No, I don't. So, but just the basics are in there right now.
How do you see this car as the industry and consumers want a higher H point? They want to sit up higher in vehicles. And you look at sedans, there's fewer and fewer interest, less and less interest in a car that's just kind of a car and low down on the ground. How does this fit in to that trend?
Boy, I don't know at the moment, Lindsay. I really couldn't answer you. You know, there's a possibility that we could fit into that trend, but right now, of course, we'll be in the sedan size, you know, right now and whatnot. So, like I said, our focus is we got to get this out. We got to get it moving. The whole team has been, like I said, very, very passionate. We were online till midnight last night going over drawings and a few odds and ends stuff. So, I mean, these guys are working around the clock with us.
Are you doing road durability miles, or are you doing basically just simulations for durability?
For the Continental one or for which one?
For your vehicle.
For the vehicle as a whole?
Yeah.
We'll be doing road.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. We'll be putting a lot of road miles on.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the intent with the vehicles that we'll build up like our pilot builds that we call S1. So next spring, we'll be having a lot of miles being put on vehicles.
Okay.
I was wondering, okay, you guys are all working on the drawings and looking at this vehicle. What was the genesis to say, hey, we want a car like this? We want to, you know, because it's unlike, I mean, we see a couple of examples, but, I mean, it's still quite different.
Yeah, I agree it is. But, you know, that's the vision of Paul Elio. You know, he's the one working along with Genesis, and it's Dave Spykerman and Mike, and, you know, those guys came up with the design initially. They've modified it over the last couple of years,
mm-hmm.
Just minor modifications.
So what did you think when you first saw it?
Well, I loved it.
Yeah?
I loved it. I had a chance to drive it right off the bat.
Uh-huh.
I enthused right from then.
Yeah?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're a big guy, Jeff.
I'm a big guy.
How'd you fit?
I fit perfectly in there.
Yeah.
Absolutely perfectly. There's a ton of room. I was at the auto show last year for the Detroit Auto Show, so that was before I joined. And there was a guy, I'm guessing he was He said he was 6'9". I don't know, could be in that area. I'm going to guess pretty big guy. Fit right in. It impressed me and everything else. But, yeah, and sitting in the vehicle now, the difference between our P5 and the E1A even gives us more room. We got about an inch more on each side. So we got a lot of room in there. A lot of head space as well. You know, we're 54, almost 55 inches in height. So, and we have a lot of good headroom.
And then for the instrumentation, I mean, it has a steering wheel, it has pedals.
Very instrumentation-wise, very simple. You know, we have the steering wheel, the driver airbag, the cluster behind it, which is RPM and the speed. Real simple light switches. We have an econ switch that we'll be using. So you can have a sport driving module, or you can have a econ module where, you know, you want to get the economy with your miles and everything else. So real simplistic.
Right. So we were talking about, you know, motorcycle-like before. I want to make sure that people understand that this is more like a car than
this
a motorcycle.
This doesn't lean into corners and all that.
It does not lean into corners, anything like that. Yeah, very, very simplistic.
So you mentioned your pricing and MPG targets. Can you ballpark any other performance characteristics, your 0 to 60 time? Or
0 to 60, we just came in. I know we have 9.6 in some of our information that's out there. The most recent we did, because of the gearing and everything, I'm floating just below 11. So right around in that area.
Is the car an overdrive in fifth, or is that direct?
Direct.
Direct, okay.
Yep, direct.
Okay. Well, Jeff, going to bring this to an end, and want to have you come back when we have a vehicle you can bring and show us.
Would love to.
We'll get a close look at that. And so Jeff Johnson, VP. Elio Motors Engineering, want to thank you very much.
Great, and thanks for having me.
Sure, great. And so now we'll get a word from our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, and we're back. So we got a comment from Wright Knight about the picture of the Corvette and the robot, and he said, from robots picking up cars to robot cars, no robot Corvettes, please. So I was thinking of the Autobots when I saw that too, because, you know, you had that yellow thing, and there was the Camaro that was the Bumblebee in the Transformers movie. So I'm at the show. There's all kinds of technology, and one of the technologies, of course, that was big there was 3D printing, additive manufacturing, and I thought it was interesting that I saw that. PSA Group just signed an agreement with an outfit called Divergent 3D for a strategic partnership in 3D metal printing. You know, so it's gone from plastics to metals. And Carlos Tavares, who is the CEO of PSA, said, and I quote, "This has a potential to dramatically scale down the size and scope of our manufacturing footprint, reduce overall vehicle weight and build complexity while also giving us almost limitless flexibility in our design output." So Lindsay, you're familiar with this stuff. So is he getting a little ahead of himself here?
Well, I don't know. The aircraft industry has been, you know, GE and Pratt & Whitney and these big turbine makers have been using 3D printing, additive manufacturing, stereolithography, whatever you want to call it, for quite a while. And the parts keep getting bigger and more complex.
Right.
And the cost of these machines has become less and less. And it's, I think, Gary, it's a big deal in the industry right now, but I think pretty soon it's going to be like CNC.
Really?
I think everybody's going to have it. You know, we've all been in GM and Ford facilities, entire floors of 3D printers.
Right.
Doing prototype parts, basically. But I think this is going to become just a common tool in the toolbox.
And so, Chris, I mean, you guys cover technology as well as automobiles. So you got the CNET part of the business, and but you, of course, are in the...
Lots of overlap these days. That's why we're there. But I agree with Lindsay. I think, you know, especially when it comes to rapid prototyping and trying out different things before production, the speed with which you can design things and use additive manufacturing, it's a real game changer.
Mm-hmm.
What I also like is I'd like to believe that it'll make it easier for those of us that like older cars sometimes to come up with, you know, weird specialty parts, you know, that somebody's put the design on the internet and, you know, you can mm-hmm. just print it out at home or somebody will print it out for you. I have a couple of 3D printed parts on my car already. They're just really tiny little things.
In your car being?
Well, I bought a weird Japanese market micro car called the Nissan POW. And one of the things you don't think about is the license plate holes don't line up. And I looked on the internet, and lo and behold, somebody 3D prints little adapters. And they're basically, you know, just, they're very simple. But otherwise, I would have had to, you know, fabricate something out of wood or figure something out or, you know. It was very helpful.
All right, so how did you buy this car? I mean, you got to tell our audience how you got this thing.
Well, actually, fortunately, it was already in the U.S. You know, thanks to the regulations, 25 years or older, cars can be brought in, and then it's a stack of paperwork and, you know, money handed in various places. But it's apparently fairly easy to do now. But thankfully, the gentleman that owned the car before was a doctor that I think he was in the Navy over in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
He was a naval doctor over there, and he bought a car over there, and he brought it back to Florida, and I purchased it off of him and had it carted mm-hmm. up from Florida.
So I actually saw it outside in the parking lot, and I think the LEO is bigger than your car.
It probably is. My car is about the size of a Fiat 500, a present-day Fiat 500.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Chris brings up a great point about restoration is really if you buy a car and it's got parts missing, all you need to do is find somebody that's got the complete vehicle, and then you scan the mail physical part, and that data goes into the 3D printer, and the machine basically can make that part. So mm-hmm. for the restoration community, I think this is a fantastic tool.
Mm-hmm. For that part, I mean, it's durable, and it's holding up, and
your
license plate hasn't fallen off?
No, there's not a lot of, you know, mechanical stress on the license plate holder. The other 3D...
When you go at high speeds, I'm sure you do on that thing.
As one does. I mean,
yes.
Triple digits are nothing. but also, you know, a jack stand cover for a Saab that I used to have, that they didn't make the cover anymore. They're notorious for falling off. Somebody 3D prints them and sells them on eBay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, you can buy little ones at Home Depot, you know, for making little plastic component parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, sort of like the little Dremels that you can carve things out with.
I saw a 3D printer at Barnes & Noble. There's the car, actually.
There it is.
Somebody ran outside and took a photograph of it.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very cool car.
It's a fun little thing.
Yeah, so that's absolutely great. So, I mean, it's sort of interesting. I mean, so, you know, the question that we had earlier about, you know, how are they going to make this LEO for $7,800 and how PSA looks to the future of being able to have printing machines that will do away with, I don't know, injection molding machines or milling machines or something else. So it seems like we're almost on a cusp of, you know, changes that in some ways go back to the early part of the auto industry where there were inventive ways to make things and not necessarily going a standard way because they didn't have a standard way.
I'm not sure. I think it's going to take a long time for even a plant full of 3D printing machines to beat the line rate of a transfer mm-hmm. press working at, you know, 60 components a minute, that kind of thing.
Right.
So it's going to take a long time. But mm-hmm. The technology's changed really quickly.
Sure, sure. So we are going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back. We're going to have our doctor data number, and that's sort of ironic that since that's who I'm supposed to be. But I'll quiz you guys on what this number is going to represent. So we'll be back in a moment.
From Shanghai to the Silicon Valley, the auto industry may make news around the globe, but there's only one spot to get your daily dose. Check out AutoLine Daily at AutoLine.tv, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern.
Okay, we're back with Chris and Lindsay. So, you know, as you guys know, I like to find bizarre numbers and things that are somewhat unusual. So I came upon a set of numbers, and I'm not going to read them all. So, Carmen, could you please bring up these numbers, the first? All right, so... As you can see, August 2016 vehicle sales in a variety of European countries, okay? So, you know, as you can see, there's, you know, an understandable range of numbers there with, you know, Spain, 64,000, but Greece, 5,600, and so on, right? So there was an astonishing thing that I discovered. What can you imagine that I would have discovered? And it has to do with an American product.
That the, take a guess, the Dodge Charger Hemi Hellcat is selling like crazy in Finland.
That's a good answer, but unfortunately, it may be correct, but it isn't the one I was looking for.
Certainly a colorful one.
Anything, Chris?
I don't know. I'm perplexed why Spain and Belgium are so far ahead, especially Spain's economy hasn't been the most robust as of late.
Yeah.
So to be a leader in something, I'm thinking that it's got to be fairly inexpensive.
It has nothing to do with these countries, though.
No.
It has to do with the United States.
But an American product in one of these countries.
Now, no. Here's the thing that astonished me. Carmen, bring it up.
The gotcha.
F-Series in August, there was not a single one of those countries that sold total number of vehicles.
And
think about that. I mean, we always say how important that car is to the Ford Motor Company. And so here is a single vehicle that is outselling the entire fleet of cars in a given month.
F-Series is really a car company unto itself within Ford. It's amazing.
And you just drove the new one?
The new 10-speed. I had one for about 5 days. I think it is the most perfectly matched gearing in a truck in the market, gearing plus powertrain of anything that's out there.
Wow.
So you think it's going to enhance those numbers that we just saw?
I don't think so. No?
No.
And the pre-production truck I had didn't even have a badge that said 10-speed on it.
You know?
It was a King Ranch version.
Right.
Though, so.
Mm-hmm. Have you driven it, Chris? Or?
I have not. And no. I'm very curious about that because as we've gone to higher and higher ratio count transmissions, there have been a few exceptions. I think ZF does a nice 8-speed in a lot of applications. But a lot of the time, I find that they're just, they're dithering between ratios too much.
That's the amazing thing about this. I mean, punch it on the highway, steady state, 70 miles per hour. It's in 10th gear. And a good thing about it, I think they learned from the Jeep ZF experience, it's got a vertical gear indicator. So you always know what gear the gearbox is in. And steady state, it's running, low RPM. You punch the thing, it'll make a 5 ratio downshift like that. But if it does go down to 5th, it'll quickly then pop up to 8th. It's a very, very smart transmission.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was impressed by it.
Mm-hmm. So, shifting gears to the other side of the world, I saw that Fiat Chrysler and the BAIC group in China are looking to possibly get together on a joint venture. They've already got a joint venture over there. And I begin to wah is, there's this discussion of the fortunes of Fiat Chrysler going forward. Do you think that there's anything deeper beyond it just being in addition to the operations they have with the Guangzhou company?
It's a good question. I mean, we certainly know that they've been looking for assistance, shall we say, and partnerships, whether that's on individual models or looking for someone to purchase the company outright. It seems like it's on the table. So, it could be a nice way to sort of test the waters, but I don't really know that I'd say that that's what's going on in this case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sergio's got to go where the money is, and the money's in China for the most part these days in terms of somebody being a benefactor.
Mm-hmm.
This is the ongoing story, whether it's a blues song or whether it's a folk song about, Chrysler, the old Chrysler group. And
it's a soap opera theme.
The soap opera theme, right.
Yeah.
Right. Days of Our Lives in Auburn Hills.
So, and I discovered something else that I thought was interesting in Magna, that they announced with BMW that they're going to be building the 5 Series in their plant in Graz, Austria. And I'm thinking, wow, isn't that odd to have a BMW built by Magna?
Is it just extra volume? Is it incremental volume? Or
apparently it's extra volume, and they have been building two Mini models in the plant, and those models will go away. And, of course, BMW owns Mini. But, I just wonder about, is there something to, the authenticity of a vehicle? Where it's built or who it's built by.
There is, but I think that's increasingly less of a factor? I mean, obviously, I think, you know, when companies like BMW and Mercedes started building vehicles in the U.S., people started, you know, wringing their hands. I think that sort of heritage is maybe more important with smaller volume, ultra high-end vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have a Ferrari, you don't want it built, you know, in Poughkeepsie, right? You want it built in Modena. And I think people are being more and more fluid with that as time goes on.
But what if there was a Ferrari plant that was in Poughkeepsie? Would it still be okay, or would it...
I think it'd be... the closest thing we have to that right now is the Acura/Honda NSX, which is, you know, built in Ohio now.
Right.
That's...
But they built a factory for it. I mean,
yeah.
It's...
Yeah.
And at one point, too, Rolls-Royces were built in Springfield, Mass.
Really?
Years ago. So, but that was before brands became important and these kind of things. And I own a Triumph motorcycle, and it's a Bonneville model, which is a very traditional model for Triumph. And you expect it to be built by guys that go out to the pub after work, and, you know, it's hand pinstripe and all the English accoutrements of a bike like that. So I'm online one night. This is a 2007 model, so it's like I've had the bike for a year. I'm online one night in a Triumph owners forum, and somebody says, you know, these bikes are being made in Thailand now. And you can tell by the seventh digit in the VIN number, if it says J, it's Jacknell Road, Hinckley, England. If it's T, it's Thailand. It's middle of February. I'm in my jammies. I run out to the garage, which is like 5 degrees below zero in Michigan, in my slippers, pull the cover off the bike with a flashlight, look down, and I see the T. It's made in Thailand. Knowing what's happening in automotive, it bothered me for maybe 10 minutes that I didn't already know that. Nothing bothered me about the design, engineering, manufacturing, quality, build, anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
Having seen what Chris was saying, you know, what's happened in automotive, it's all about the brand. I mean, you know, Mini's made by BMW. It was a big question when Honda came to the U.S., whether American-made Hondas would be as good as Japan-made Hondas.
Mm-hmm.
I owned an early, I owned the last of the German-made VW Golfs in 78. My sister bought a 79, which was the first ones made in Pennsylvania. Terrible car. My car was great. But VW had carried over every problem with the German-made cars, including the windshield leaking on your feet in a rainstorm, was carried over to Pennsylvania. I don't think we have that problem anymore, but I really don't think it's an issue.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of VW, you were just out driving VWs, I understand. And
right.
So what was the tenor? So this was a full line
full line launch.
So how many diesels did they show?
None, but their U.S. VP of product planning will not completely shut the door on diesel. Although every presentation was prefaced by a 20-minute. We're so sorry. We are going to make this right, meaning the diesel dilemma, debacle. We're going to make it right with our customers, with our dealers, et cetera. He got up there, his colleague got up there, and every presentation, you know, had that kind of built into it. So,
mm-hmm.
And it's a shame because we drove this new all-track Golf Sport Wagon, which gets 30 mpg with a gas engine on the highway versus, you know, the old diesel version was in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So... they've lost a lot losing diesels.
Mm-hmm. So did you get a sense of you know, what their alternative will be to diesel? I mean, was there a lot of talk of electrification or...
Yeah, they have to bring... I mean, this was part of the deal with when they got caught, was heavy electrification, both in Germany and over here. So they've got a bunch of stuff coming, you know, from 2018 on that'll be increasingly electrified, both mm-hmm. them and Audi.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big gap for them now in terms of product, it feels like.
You know, huge gap.
It's really disappointing that they've had this gulf with, you know, SUVs, crossover SUVs. They've got very little for the next, you know, 12 to 18 months at least.
And the Chattanooga vehicle, it's almost like that last Ford Thunderbird. It seems like we've been talking about this thing forever.
Yeah.
And it's not coming out till later next year. So.
Right, right. So, good cars otherwise?
Yeah, I tell you, my... favorite EV is still the e-Golf.
Yeah.
Solid platform, fun to drive. If you're in a temperate climate where you're not worried about the battery kind of losing range when it gets cold, it gives you like 85, 90 miles of range. What's not to like?
Mm.
Real fun car to drive.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite car in their lineup right now.
Okay. Well, so What I want to do is we're gonna take another quick break. We're gonna come back with a phone call that we have, and unfortunately, Elio's gone, so I have an answer here for them. And then I want to talk about some other things that we've heard this week about autonomy, about electric range. A lot is going on this week. So we're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to hear from our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. So we have a phone call. Could you please bring that in?
Hi, this is Warren from Southern California. I have a question here for the gentleman from Elio. If I had purchased an Elio and later on wanted to add some accessories, would I have to take the car back to the marshaling center, or would the accessories be available, say, over the counter, where I could have them either installed myself here or by one of the service dealers? I understand Pep Boys is going to be doing that. Thanks for being there. Looking forward to the Elio coming out.
Okay.
Take care.
All right, thank you. So as Jeff is no longer sitting in this chair, but we do, through the magic of the internet, have an answer from him. And accessories can be purchased at the dealerships or through Pep Boys, and depending on the accessory, you can install them yourself. So when that Elio comes out, you'll be able to mod it all up. So you were mentioning the range of the eGolf this week, that General Motors announced the 238-mile range for the Chevy Bolt. I would argue that this is a big week in the history of the electric car because of that. What do you guys think?
I think that's a fair statement. Obviously, the reality is that most people's commutes, you know, if you have 50, 60 miles of range, you're covered. But the fear, you know, the range anxiety, and maybe not having a charge point every day, really, I think, discourages purchase of EVs. And something that has that kind of range, that's, you know, comparable to an IC-powered car, is very impressive. And actually, our own Tim Stevens actually got an early drive of that vehicle, and was able to test out the range on Highway 1, I think last week or the week before. And he got over 250 miles just in normal driving.
Mm-hmm.
Without really freaking out about, you know, running without the air conditioning off the whole time. Or
he wasn't hyper-miling it. He was just driving the car.
He was just driving it like a normal vehicle, and he was very impressed with it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Lindsay?
Yeah, I agree with Chris. I think this is kind of a tipping point from the luxury BEV that we've seen, you know, Tesla make a lot of hay out of and done a good job with it, the $70,000 to $120,000 level. And I think this car, if they can keep it at $30,000 with the $7,000, you know, give back, basically, this kind of democratizes battery electric vehicles. And it's really a quite compelling little package for getting around town. And, you know, we have to wait, being here in the snow belt, we've got to wait to see really what the practical range is for a four-season driving environment,
right,
versus California. We know those cars will get 238 plus, as Chris was saying, maybe 250 miles. But mm-hmm. What's it going to be in, you know, late fall through late winter time in Michigan and other states like that? But I really think this is really bringing a kind of a people's aspect into practical battery electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm. And so you think the gasoline prices are going to keep people from buying even a compelling car like the Bolt?
I think it'll be a factor for sure, because if you look at the form factor and the size of that vehicle, it wouldn't be comparable normally to a $30,000 vehicle, or $37,500 is what they're targeting before incentives.
Right, so it's $7,500 federal tax credit.
Right,
so
right.
That brings it to $30,000.
Right, and if you would look, you know, you might be looking at a, you know, Mazda 3 or something like that, that'd be in the 20s somewhere, and maybe on the high end loaded, it'd start to touch 28, mm-hmm. that range. So there's definitely still going to be a pricing gulf. What I'm curious about is if it will pull reservation holders out of the Model 3, which I think is, you know, to be frank, a much sexier looking vehicle, and there's a buzz around Tesla, but those vehicles aren't practically going to show up in numbers, I would guess, for, what do you think, at least 18 months?
Yeah.
If not significantly longer. I mean, if you're reservation holder number 80,000,
right,
you're not getting your car for a long time. And you see something like that that's already on the market, that actually has a dealership that's on your corner and already has a lot of history behind the brand, I think you got to look at that and go, well, that's kind of a compelling alternative.
Although I got to believe that if you're reservation holder 80,000, that by the time you'd get to 80,000, that Elon will have introduced the Model 10, and therefore it will be a non-issue because there'll be so many iterations between then and now.
But it brings up an interesting juxtaposition of this startup, high-tech Silicon Valley automaker, and you know General Motors that went through you know a cleansing and bankruptcy, and you know it's still quite a formidable technology company, mm-hmm. Even though this car had a lot of GM Korea. And really, LG Chem engineering and design.
Right. Well, speaking of the difference between high tech companies and traditional automobile manufacturers, there was a bit of a kerfuffle this week. The Michigan Senate passed a couple of bills that are going to the point of regulating self-driving cars, saying that basically automobile manufacturers will be capable of getting permission of doing this. And John Krafcak from Google said, wait a minute, guys, you know, we're not an automobile manufacturer, but we're a developer of autonomous vehicles. We're not going to have the right to be able to do our cars on the roads of Michigan. What do you guys make of that?
Well, I think it's interesting. It's a question of the intent of the language. Because if you depending on how you read it, it may have just been happenstance that it was worded that way, because Google is not presently an auto manufacturer, and in fact, you know, they may, or one of their other companies that are out there may in fact just add technology to somebody else's existing vehicle.
Right.
Will they not be able to have autonomous vehicles on the road here in Michigan? Right now, autonomous vehicles are legal for testing purposes, but the laws that were proposed and passed last week, I think, allow for the retail sale of them to consumers even without steering wheels. It's basically, we're throwing the doors wide open. We want to be, you know, the leaders in this in the state, so we're not going to put any impediments in place. But it is interesting that, you know, obviously we have our native auto industry here, and, you know, a company like Google or Uber or what have you that are also getting involved in this field, arguably excluded because of this language.
Right. So the question of the wording, I mean, was it done so, oh, we'll protect the big three rather than having these guys from Silicon Valley come in?
Well, you got to wonder if Google's technology headquarters was in, you know, Sterling Heights.
Right.
I don't think we'd be talking about this.
Yeah,
right now,
see, and that's the thing that you wonder about. And I just think that's sort of interesting. And but I mean, to get to your point of when we were talking about the Bolt and the, you know, the fact that, you know, General Motors is an advanced technology company, as is Ford. You were in the autonomous fusion this week, Chris?
I was. It was a brief experience, but as part of Ford's further two-day trends conference, they allowed journalists and tastemakers and such to experience their autonomous fusions for the first time. It was a very quick, very simple course, I'd say. It was, you know, basically around their grounds, but it was in live traffic.
Mm-hmm.
They did have a demonstration where they had basically a planted person step out in front of the vehicle and all that. And it really took...
Was it a real human?
Yeah, it was a real person.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're only going, you know, 25, 30 miles an hour. And there were other, you know, live traffic vehicles going in and out. It was impressive. You know, nothing untoward happened. It definitely was a very conservative programming. You know, when somebody came in late from the side in a Dodge Ram truck at a four-way stop, and they just moved slightly, everything stopped again, and it with a smoothness that you might not want in a production car.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really a question of the after you programming that's being baked into these cars, where a single pedestrian can walk in front of a car and just, you know, stop everything that's happening.
Right.
I've been in other more dynamic environments in autonomous cars already. About a year ago, I was in Tokyo in an autonomous Nissan Leaf in live Tokyo traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was a much more impressive demonstration, to be perfectly honest with you. They also had, you know, little LiDAR sensors built into the bodywork. They didn't have the big spinning assembly on the roof and all of that.
Mm.
It wasn't without its problems as well, but it really shows just how far everybody's going, that, you know, they can just let people en masse into these vehicles now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're mentioning Uber. So this week they had, four Ford Fusions out there and are giving people in the streets of Pittsburgh the opportunity to be in these vehicles. But there are, of course, engineers in this case for now. So it's not like the robot is coming to pick you up with your ride-hailing service.
Right, yeah, that's interesting, too. And I think they're also going to be working with Volvo on some XC90s like that.
Yeah, next year.
Yeah, and it's right now I think the rides are free. So if you, by luck of the draw, pull up your Uber app and you call it and then you get the robotic car, the ride's on them because they're test miles.
Right.
But there's still somebody in the driver's seat, you know, hands off, just waiting for things to, you know, require human intervention.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting period that we're entering, you know, when you see these kind of pilot programs in cities and Delphi doing a thing in Singapore and Uber's experiment in Pittsburgh. And I think we're going to be seeing more of this, probably Ann Arbor, Michigan, maybe Detroit, as the state of Michigan starts to bring more of this up.
It's because Google can't do it. No, I mean,
yeah, earlier in the summer, I attended a thing up on I-69, which is north of Detroit, where the U.S. Army's Tank Automotive Command is going to be testing convoys of autonomous trucks up there. Mm-hmm. That the state of Michigan has kind of wired the area for infrastructure. And, you know, all over the country, I think we're going to be seeing, you know, more and more of this kind of stuff. And we'll all end up behind those vehicles and go, how come this guy is... Oh, this guy's garbage truck's parked on the right. How come this guy won't go around him? Well, it's an autonomous car. Mm-hmm. It's going to be some frustration, I think, from many of us as we see these things and we interact with them in traffic.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Uber has purchased this technology company that is Otto, O-T-T-O, that is developing autonomous semi-trucks. And Freightliner has the Inspiration truck that is... an autonomous vehicle. And I think that, you know, one of the rationalizations, though, for these trucks, that they'll go at a set speed, and so you, of course, will just pass it, right? I mean, you won't worry about it jerking around and perhaps impeding your hasty way as you're moving along the highways and byways.
Well, and I think, you know, the advent of the truly connected car will help all of that a lot. So you will have a lot less of the rubbernecking and the, you know, the accordion effect of traffic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It should smooth it out some,
right,
as vehicles become more aware of what's up ahead,
mm-hmm,
down the road. And I think, you know, the transportation and logistics side of autonomy is particularly fascinating. And that business is, you know, to use the vernacular, it's ripe for disruption, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, and they want to get safer driving, and they want to get the drivers out of the equation. There's a shortage of drivers in semi-trucks.
They can't find drivers.
No, and it has been for a really long time,
mm-hmm,
already. I was actually in Germany last week with Mercedes-Benz, and they showed basically their autonomous vision of the future for trucks, and they showed off a lot of the partners that they're teaming up with, you know, for drone delivery services and things of that
nature. Launching drones from the roofs of cars.
Correct.
It's crazy, man.
It really is. And basically their whole thing is that they're pivoting their truck business, you know, the Sprinters, the Vitos, and all that stuff, from just purely being a manufacturer model to being a logistics company.
Mm-hmm.
They'll offer, you know, the rentals, basically short term, mm-hmm, long term. They'll handle all the fleet logistics for you, and they're really pivoting their whole division around that premise.
Mm-hmm. You know, apparently Mark Fields talked to investors this week and was talking about how the new business services that Ford is getting involved with. Was it last week they bought a company in San Francisco that is basically a ride-hailing service that's based on Ford Transit vehicles and so on. And so he's basically saying that at some point that will be delivering margins of 20%, which is about two and a half times the margins that the car business does. So when you were at the Ford event with the Future Vision, did this come up at all? I mean, what, you know, the transformation to more of a services company?
Well, you know, Ford's been saying for a while now that they want to be a mobility company,
mm-hmm, yeah,
that they're not just a manufacturer anymore. And they're obviously, you know, putting their fingers in a lot of different pies. So that, yes, that was a theme. And they are looking at lots of different solutions to this. You know, do we want to do change the purchase model? Do we want to look at ride hailing? And I think one of the things they're hanging their hat on is, you know, these vehicles, even though people won't be purchasing as many new cars, you know, for personal use, these services are probably going to rack up a lot of miles on their vehicles a lot faster,
right?
Because they're going to be in use 24/7,
mm-hmm.
And then you know the wear through rate on those things is going to increase business for you know their service providers at dealer level,
mm-hmm.
And also just for you know replacement vehicle needs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is that question with volume, and you look at ride hailing. I mean, Uber's model is to eventually get rid of all the people whose cars they're using right now, and you know, if this still exists, it'll either go to fully autonomous or somebody's going to have to buy a lot of cars.
Right.
So.
You know, and it's sort of interesting to think about it. Like, so right now, whether it's Uber or Lyft, I mean, those companies are not paying for the vehicles, right? So if the three of us just decided at this very moment, damn it, we're going to become Uber drivers, okay, it's going to be based on our vehicles. There's no cost to Uber, right? But if they have the robot cars,
they've got to buy those cars if they're going to stay in that business.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, some people have speculated that the automakers will end up getting into that in some way.
Right.
Buying the Lyfts and the, who knows.
Well, I mean, General Motors put a sizable chunk of money in Lyft. But,
yeah.
And you know, but I always thought that the reason they were doing that was to get the data so they can figure things out. I mean, the same thing with Chariot in Ford situation to see the patterns because, you know, you were saying if we have these cars running for 24 hours, well, we have to figure out precisely how we're going to marshal and distribute these vehicles on a regular basis so somebody's not sitting there waiting like, maybe I should have bought that car rather than depending on this thing that never seems to show up when I need it.
Well, there's no doubt that data is, you know, not the final frontier, but it is a big component of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And the value of that data, what it tells you about consumer habits, what it tells you about the movement of populations and all of that, how can automakers turn around and monetize that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is the car, the autonomous car of the future going to tell you that there's, you know, a special on Big Macs when you drive by the McDonald's? And, you know, is that going to lower the cost of the ride because you're subjecting yourself to advertising? There's all sorts of different ways to make money.
I was just in cabs this week in Chicago, and I saw lots of ads, and it didn't drive the price of that cab ride down.
No.
You couldn't shut it down either. I mean, it was just blurring.
On all the time, yeah. Yeah.
So, but it's you know, obviously things are changing, but I mean, there'll still be guys like you buying these wacky little micro cars, and Lindsay buying his Triumph motorcycle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm very excited and bullish on the future of the autonomous automobile. In that it can mobilize populations that otherwise didn't have that ability to
and
be
it's
mobile.
Huge. Yeah.
The elderly, the very young, the disabled.
Right.
I think it's a fundamental game changer for society as a whole, and I can't, you know, overstate that. I really believe that. But at the same time, you know, we've talked about this before. I'm worried that people like us that like to drive vehicles for pleasure, it's going to become either illegal or at least practically prohibitive because the cost of insurance or something like that goes through the roof for human-driven cars because they're the only ones causing accidents. So I'm very concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I still question whether it's really going to do anything with congestion at the end of the day. You know, congestion and parking. You're still having these vehicles. More people will be getting around. Not everybody wants to get into a vehicle with six other people and have the vehicle decide what rank order. You're going to be dropped off first. You're going to be dropped off second. I'm going to be dropped off third or whatever. You know, is it really going to get rid of the congestion problem? I think that's still to be determined.
But if you take six people out who are iffy drivers due to aging, their vision maybe isn't what it ought to be, their reflexes not so good. I mean, we've seen drivers like this. I mean, I'm sure when we're driving home today, you're going to run into some of those people. Take those six people out of the equation, and suddenly you have six fewer that'll be causing congestion. So.
Well, you could, but now they also want to ride somewhere too. You might be taking them out of having a driver's license, but mm-hmm. they're still going to want to go somewhere. They might not want to go with five other people in the car.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I think the question's still to be answered.
All right. So final question to both you guys: what's your prediction in terms of timing for this?
In terms of what level? Four autonomy?
There'll be level four autonomy in ride-hailing applications. So we can't go buy one of these things, but we could use one of these things.
In what sort of availability? Because, you know, Ford's already saying 2018 we'll have that. And I have a feeling that that'll probably be a very limited test market. It might be like at an airport or something like that where you can hail it and go from one terminal to another. Something very limited. Or in a city center in a prescribed area. As far as widespread availability, I think we're still a ways off.
All right. So you go to Chicago and you want a vehicle. When will you be able to get one that will be autonomous?
That you can buy privately?
No, that you will get through a service.
Oh, you can, okay.
Because all the insurance and legality.
So you're in Chicago and you want to go, you know, from one part of Chicago to another and you want to use the ride hailing app to get an autonomous vehicle to go to you. It's a good question.
Should we make a bet on the show?
We buy
each other a beer, whoever wins in 2025. I don't know.
That was actually the number that I was going to default to.
2025?
2030, yeah.
Yeah. 2030, come on.
I'll say 2025.
I don't disagree with that. I think that's probably a good ballpark.
I think it's sooner.
Yeah?
I think 2021.
And how soon until all three of us are out of a job?
No, CB, you'll be writing about all these fascinating processors that are making all of these things better. And Lindsay, you'll be writing about the LIDAR systems that are the size of a thumbnail and all that good stuff. But no, I just think things are happening so quickly. I mean, you know, Toyota just announced today that they're hooking up with some, you know, robotic research company that goes outside what they normally do. And one of the reasons they're doing that is because they want to do R&D in a different way. And, you know, and then they, oh, by the way, donated $1 million to a charitable fund that's associated with this outfit.
I think the weird uncle in the basement on this is the liability, the whole issue of liability. And as Chris said, you know, it's one thing to have a very U of M campus, you know, and then U of M buys a certain amount of insurance that if anything goes wrong with this network of vehicles that's taking people around from the engineering building to the English building, et cetera, that they can't be sued, that they'll have protection on that. Take these things, we're all so close to it. Take these things out, and as Chris said, put them in the middle of Tokyo or in the middle of Detroit or New York or whatever. Becomes a very different risk, level of risk. And I think that's what we've got to, you know, the technology is going to be there. And I think you're right, 2021-ish, something like that. But I think there's a lot to be worked out on the liability side. My own feeling.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Lindsay Brook, skeptic. No. SAE. So thanks for Lindsay for coming back here again. Chris Pocket, it's always good to see you. And you'll be driving home in that little thing, and there'll be all this congestion, but you'll zip right around.
But I'll be having fun.
Okay.
Slowly.
Okay. So, okay, we want to thank you all for tuning in, and I think this was an enjoyable show, and I had fun. Did you guys have fun?
Absolutely. Thank
always.
You.
All right. So, see you back here next week. John will be here. And so with that, have a good day.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.